And when recording begins again, there is only relief there, one hopes. Now, when there's no you in that, there's no you there, right? In that sense of self. When there's no self there, self, you, is neither here nor yonder nor between the two. And this, exactly this, just this, is the end of all suffering. Much as the quote that Bill had in his handout. The one toward the end. Yeah. With what manner of insight and not grasping anything in the world, in this world, does a person realize Nibbana? Let the person, let him or her, completely cut off the root of concepts tinged with a prolific tendency, namely the thought I am. In other words, relax the thought, relax the sense, relax the presumption of I am. This, just this, is the end of all suffering. As the story goes, Bahia was enlightened on the spot. It was like those ones, right? It was wonderful. Then, to complete the high drama, alas, shortly thereafter, after the Buddha and Bahia parted company, Bahia encountered an ox who gored him, and Bahia died. When the Buddha was told this, he said, well, at least he was awakened before this life ended. You know, not like whatever, not indifferent, you know, to his suffering, but, you know, at least a good thing happened, a wonderful thing, you know, before his life came to an end, as all lives will come to an end, right? So let's talk about what that might be in the brain. What might this state be? What might be the neural causes and conditions that promote this state of consciousness, either as an attainment or moving in that direction? Because as the Tibetans say, we can take the fruit as the path. In other words, we can take the end as the beginning. We can take the destination as the journey. For example, we can attempt to practice this way. So, also as the Tibetans say, moments of awakening, many times a day, right? Or I also like the phrase, gradual cultivation, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation. Moments of insight, then we kind of backfill, right? We build infrastructure, which then support the next moment of awakening that launches us even farther along. So how do we do that, particularly in terms of the brain? Well, I want to show you here a very interesting slide, for me at least, that has to do with two ways of being. Now, in reality, these sharp dualisms are not so present. And in reality, people move back and forth. To kind of give you a clue as to where my story's going, the left-hand column is associated with activation of midline neural networks, medial. The right-hand column, mental states, are associated with lateral activations, particularly in the right side of the brain. But if you just look at those lists for a moment, you can see that those matched pairs correspond to a lot of dichotomies that you'll see in the field of personal growth, psychology, psychopathology, and different spiritual traditions. Right? In many ways, classically in spiritual life, we're trying to get out of the left-hand column into the right-hand column. Right? Now, there are other ways to look at these two columns, and without attempting to be controversial about it, probably 30, 40, 50 years ago, it would not have been surprising if something a lot like the left-hand column and something a lot like the right-hand column had the word masculine at the top of the left-hand column and feminine at the top of the right-hand column. Or in anthropology, again, more in decades or generations past, the left-hand column would be labeled civilized, and the right-hand column would be labeled primitive. Right? Hunter-gatherer, pre-industrial. Those labels, and I'm just offering them because to really appreciate the resonance here, the implications of these two lists, you know, are you know, fraught with trouble. That's why I like the very neutral labeling, you know, medial and lateral, because it's not so full of all kinds of connotations that have been used against women obviously, in history, or used against indigenous peoples. Okay. So, if we have an interest in being able at will increasingly to drop into the right-hand mode, which I think is very much the Bahia mode, all right? It's interesting to discover the fact that it's hard to do that and stay there, isn't it? Haven't we all had the experience often that we're trying to go into open, spacious mindfulness, just presence, here and now, not much language, mind very quiet, not goal-directed, nowhere to go, nothing to do, no one to be, right? The traditional instruction, no self needed here. Selves need not apply on the cushion for this particular job right here and now, okay? It's hard to stay there. So let's look at some of the neurology of that challenge. So, what seems to be the case is that, and these are a series of pictures from one particular, actually this is a different study, I'll show you another study a little further on. The key here is that when subjects in this study were doing a lot of self-reference thought, so for example, look at the bottom two categories or attributes. Or descriptors of a mode of being. In the medial mode, self is very prominent. Tons of selfing, right? Lots of self as object. In other words, self as the protagonist in the little mini movie, I, the self as subject, am now watching in the theater of the mind for the next 10 seconds, right? Lots of, internal mini movie thinking about, anticipating a situation. Okay, I want this to go well. If I act this way, they'll treat me badly. If I act that way, they'll treat me better. Okay, I better act that way. You see what I mean? We do that all the time. It's quite useful, as long as we don't get too attached to that particular eddy in the stream. That's medial activation, self-referential activation. The lateral activation does not have very much sense of self, either as object or subject. And we can see that in our experiencing, can't we? When we kind of drop out of task-focused, future-focused mental activity, or we drop out of resentful or reproachful or regretful rumination about our past, right? I've been cheated and mistreated, when will I be loved, right? When we drop out of that, we drop into the lateral mode. Not much sense of self there, if at all. You were really a lot in the lateral mode in that practice we did. And if I may be forgiven, another little sidebar. The reason I did, and it's interesting, I slipped it in kind of early on. Remember how we went through, I said there are three fundamental motivational systems. And one is to approach the pleasant, one is to avoid the unpleasant, and one is to affiliate with us, right? Those are three evolutionarily derived deep systems that enable organisms to pass on their genes. Interestingly, sharks and lizards have the approach-avoid system, but they don't have the affiliation system. The affiliation system in the brain is a wonderful development in evolution in about the last 80 or so million years, starting with birds and mammals breaking off, who do what lizards and tuna don't do. What do birds and mammals do that lizards and tuna fish don't do? What?
Flock.
Yeah, they flock. They hang out. Well, they pair. Well, fish flock. You could say schools of fish, Birds and mammals, what?
Nurture their young.
Yeah, they pair bond and raise their young. And to do that, you got to be smarter than a lizard or a spider or a shark that has its young and then kind of swims back, and if the young are around, it'll eat them, like whatever, right? Actually, interesting, in proportion to body weight, the brains of birds and mammals are bigger than the brains of reptiles and fish. Because, to be a squirrel or a wren, to kind of pick a good mate and then work it out, who watches the kids, who goes to get the nuts or worms, brings them back, how are you going to work it out? If any of you had been a couple and become parents, oh my God, there's so much more to do. As a neuroscientist say, the computational requirements of pair bonding and child rearing are much greater than just hooking up, having a few eggs, and moving on, right? And then along come primates. There's a direct correlation between the size of the brain in proportion to body weight, or the size of the cortex, actually, in proportion to body weight, and the size of the primate band and its social complexity, like the number of grooming partners and so forth, direct correlation there, getting another jump in the affiliation system and the evolution of the brain. And then human beings, as I said, whose brains have, our brains have tripled in size just in the last 2.5 million or so years. And most of that build-out has to do with relational functions. Arguably then, most fundamentally, over the last 800 million years, the primary driver of the evolution of the brain has been love, broadly defined. It's not been tool using. It's not been aggression or war. It's been love, broadly defined, which is kind of cool, makes me kind of happy. It's been the affiliation system. So the affiliation system is really important. All that said, those three systems can be used and are typically mainly used for suffering purposes. You know, for example, approaching, if we don't get the carrot we want, we feel disappointed, frustrated, upset. Or, you know, Linus and Lucy, or whatever, Charlie Brown and Lucy, you know, he thinks he's going to get to kick that ball yet again, and she rips it away. Ooh, suffering begins. On the other hand, I think a lot about what is the nature of the awakened brain, the realized brain, given that it's, you know, so endowed with hard, hard wiring that's the result of very successful ancestors who are anxious and cranky and self-focused, right? How in the world can you get enlightened with a brain like that? I've been really, really thinking about that. And that's not in my book. This is something I've really been mulling and developing. And I think clearly with regard to the approaching system, that system is still there, but it's not driven by scarcity or lack or frustration, but is in fact driven by an a priori, an already felt sense of fullness, completeness and wholeness, and wholesome aspirations. And the same kind of parallel you'll see for the approaching, pardon me, for the affiliating and the avoiding system. The affiliating system is full of suffering. I've been treated, am mistreated, when will I be loved? That's the affiliation system in pain, full of suffering right there. On the other hand, awakened beings are loving, they're kind. It's a friend of mine who lived amongst, as a monk in Southeast Asia for 9 years, said to me when I asked him about what were enlightened people like, because there were, you know, people, a few, who were considered to be arahants, you know, which is the fourth stage of enlightenment in the Buddhist tradition, or darn close to it, you know, in the forest traditions there in Southeast Asia. He said, well, they were kind of always the same. In other words, their happiness and the way they were, their peace, was not based on conditions. For example, if you were really nice to them, they really loved you. If you were really awful to them, they really loved you. You know. So I think that's the nature of a person whose affiliation system is still running, but it's a system that's moved beyond suffering, or is close to it. And then last, in the avoiding system, obviously there's a lot of fear and anger, or in reaction to the unpleasant, a lot of aversion. There's a lot of fight, flight, freeze, right? That's driven by our response to the sticks, the threats, the unpleasant experiences of life. There's a lot of suffering there when that system lights up. On the other hand, enlightened beings restrain what's unwholesome. They're strong. Think about Thich Nhat Hanh or the Dalai Lama, not necessarily enlightened, but, you know, definitely highly awakened. You know, they're still engaged in the world. They're still speaking truth to power. Right? But they're not doing it they're not going to war. The Dalai Lama is not at war with the Chinese government. He's certainly not at war with the Chinese people. You know, his line is, my friends, the enemy Chinese. They're his adversaries. My friends, my adversaries here. He's not at war with them. Right? In other words, he's in a state of peace. So if you think about taking the fruit as a path, for each one of these systems, imagine a way of being in which one is grateful in terms of the approaching system, in which one is loving, because being loving makes one feel loved in a wonderful kind of way. It feeds us as it moves through us. And also peaceful, grateful, loving, and peaceful as a way to both practice as a mode of life and as a way of living the attainments, if I could use that word, of people who seem really, really close to or at the end of the journey. So slipping that in, isn't it interesting that when that's present, there's not that much selfing? When those three systems are disturbed, No? When there's a lot of frustration in the approaching system or disappointment, when there's a lot of rejection or unlovedness in the affiliating system, or there's a lot of fear and anger in the avoiding system, wow, there's a lot of selfing, isn't there? Thus selfing begins and suffering follows. On the other hand, when there is instead gratitude, love, and peace, the conditions of selfing have really diminished. Not much selfing needed. So if one is wanting to support oneself in diminishing self-activations, a wonderful path in that is to take the fruit as the path and increasingly focus on, to use a single word to encompass a lot of stuff for each one of these three systems, gratitude, love, and peace. Okay. So now, continuing. Another picture here is a different study. This is a FARB study in which they had people do two tasks inside an MRI. And they showed them two lists of words. They were trait adjectives like curious, fearful, friendly, irritable, possessive, generous, whatever. And then in the first condition, they just told people, now think about those as they apply to you. Like, how am I generous? How am I not? Am I thrifty? When was I thrifty? When was I not thrifty? Did I blow a lot of money last year in Hawaii? You know, a lot of self-referencing, right? And then they had them do the same thing with the same words, so the conditions are the same, with the only difference being, they said, as best you can, just kind of look at that word. The word will pop up on a little screen just above your eye. You know, your eyes, they're in the scanner, right? This big sound scanner, MRI thing going there. And just look at that word, thrifty or curious, and just be spaciously aware of whatever arises. Those are the two conditions. So the second condition, what does it sound like? Meditation, right? Mindfulness, open, spacious presence, right? Okay. So when they're in the first condition, self-referencing thought, midline activations occurred. So the key slide here is on the, or the key image is the right of the two. See where all the red blobbies are? That's where there's differential activation. Those regions are probably 2 to 3% more metabolically active, which is about all the difference is that you normally see in an MRI picture. It's not like the rest of the brain has gone dark, right? It hasn't. It's like a refrigerator. It's always on, 24/7. It's just that those particular regions were a little more active. And so the contrast is what we see. Again, it goes to what Bill said earlier. It's the contrast that make a stimulus. Okay. Going a little further, the distinction here, now we're getting really into what it takes to stabilize lateral activation, lateral mode being. Lateral mode of being. Self-referential activation is blue. I kind of wish they switched the colors because like blue is good and red is bad, but won't go there. I'm not trying to be political, more I'm thinking like green light, red light. But anyway, notice interestingly, self-referential activation, especially in the right hand of the two, that's really where you can see what they're trying to say, is midline, whereas the other activation, lateral mode, is on the sides, especially in the right-hand side of the brain, which is much less verbal, much more gestalt, much more whole, much more now, much less sequential. Time is sequential. The main difference between the left and the right hemisphere is the left hemisphere is specialized for sequential processing. That's why the left hemisphere is involved in language, because language is sequential for it to mean anything. If you mix up the order of, you know, subjects and nouns and sentences, you're in trouble in English or whatever. And then also motor planning is very much a left hemisphere activity for most people. Some people it's reversed. On the right-hand side of the brain, typically it's specialized for gestalt processing. You know, everything all at once now. Well, that's the nature of imagery. An image is one whole thing, just like that. All right. Interestingly, in the first 18 months or so of life, the right hemisphere seems to develop a little more rapidly and to consolidate and kind of build out its programs a little more rapidly, which seems to make sense. And then language starts coming in. Not coincidentally, when the left hemisphere starts developing in the second half of the second year of life, around 18 months and on. The right hemisphere is really useful to track events in space because that's where threats come at one. It's really important to track what's happening around one, the environment. All right. Okay, so again, we can see that activation of the lateral mode, you know, when people are just in open, spacious awareness. Next slide. Actually, I want to just do this for a second. Now, here's another interesting story. They did this study in two phases, before and after training. So in phase one, with no training, they had their subjects activate kind of open, spacious awareness with just whatever is arising in the mind in response to that stimulus, that particular word and the next word, right? And they could do it. It was great for about 5 seconds. That's how long they could sustain lateral activation. And they experienced what we've all experienced on the cushion, right? You go into open, spacious awareness, and the next thing you know, you're lost in thought. Me, you know, within the perspective of I, and very often in which I is the protagonist of the story, right? The little mini movie running. Isn't that right? And so that was without training, which seems consistent with our own experience. With training, though, people increasingly were able to stabilize lateral mode activation. They were able, in other words, to keep medial tyranny, medial hegemony from incorporating, co-opting, colonizing. Think of the movie Avatar, you know, think of the movement of civilization into the world. You know, they didn't, it didn't grab hold of, I'm being deliberately biased here, just for a purpose. Medial, they were able to keep the lateral, they were able to create a refuge in their brain for the activation of the mental states associated with the lateral mode of being. They were able to preserve neural refuge. It's kind of a cool phrase to think of. You know, neural refuge for not having much sense of self, being in the now, not much language, not much sense of tension around, you know, achieving a goal or fearing a threat, right? Okay? And that's just after 8 weeks, total beginners, pretty good. Basic mindfulness training, probably an MBSR protocol was used, a basic mindfulness-based stress reduction protocol. Okay. All right? So you see that slide so far? So now just for a moment, and then happy to open it up for questions and comment, ways to activate the two modes. Because here again is where knowing something about the black box can actually be helpful. Because there are different ways to promote the neural substrate of the one mode of being or the other. And to go back to where we started, or I started rather, on Friday night, if you recall, I kind of flashed a slide up there, which is where I ended with my part. One can use the mind to change the brain, to change the mind for the better. Historically, obviously, the Buddha was an extraordinary yogi, and all kinds of people have practiced. They did not need MRIs and EEGs. They did not need this workshop, whatever, to practice and see clearly and attain awakening. All right? They understood, and especially increasingly in, you know, Western psychology and so forth and science, it's been understood that if you do mental activity A and you get mental result C, it's presumed to be via the black box B of the brain. Except nobody knew how that happened. They just kind of, you know, it reminds me of that New Yorker cartoon, you know, these two scientist guys looking at a chalkboard of, you know, all these equations and squiggles. They both kind of look like Albert Einstein. You know, and at the very end, one of them, the final term in the equation, this plus that times that divided by this, down at the very end, you know, he says, and let there be light. It's like the X factor, right? It was just presumed there's the X factor, the black box. We don't know about it. Now let's move on, right? Okay. Freud knew there was a black box, but he just had no idea what was going on. Increasingly, though, we're starting to connect the dots. How does mental activity A stimulate and strengthen neural state B, neural substrate B? Because if you stimulate it, you get those neurons firing, automatically they start wiring. Okay? How does wholesome mental activity A, or skillful mental activity A, stimulate and strengthen neural substrate B that promotes mental state of interest C, like love, happiness, wisdom, compassion, release, disenchantment, equanimity, loving kindness? Okay? So this is an example of some ways to do that. Now, there's a place for the medial mode, right? There's a place for getting out emails. There's a place for thinking our way through a tough situation. How am I going to work this in the office with the weird politics there? You know, how am I going to kind of navigate the fact that my kid's on the highly spirited end of the normal temperamental spectrum, and yet is in fifth grade and has got to learn long division or fourth grade, whenever they teach that stuff these days? What do I do? All right, there's a place for that. You want to go medial? Fine. I have clients. I'm trying to train them in medial. Right? I want to go back to those things, if you bear with me for a moment. Some people need more medial. Right? I'll make the observation that's probably occurred to you already. Conventional schooling is an intensive training in medial activation. Modern culture is an intensive training in a medial mode of being. You know, like it or not, and we have a lot of casualties walking around the streets and in the school systems who are just not that suited for A, medial training, and B, they're just not that medial. They're more lateral. On the other hand, where does creativity come from? Where do most breakthroughs come from? It comes from lateral activation. You know, there, you may know the famous story of the fellow who figured out, finally, what in the world is the chemical structure that is at the heart of organic chemistry, organic carbon-based compounds. Do you know this story? He was struggling and struggling. It was a huge problem. It was equivalent to the structure of DNA. It was so intractable and difficult. And he grappled and grappled and grappled. I forget when this happened. I think it was late in the 19th century, like the 1800s, late 1800s ballpark. The true story is he goes to sleep. Right? He sleeps on it. And he has a dream in which a snake is biting its tail. And he wakes up, like, oh my God! And he writes it down. And then he goes back to sleep. And then he wakes up in the morning, and what does he see on his piece of paper? The benzene ring. This six-sided hexagonal ring of the carbon, you know how the carbon molecules are fundamental structure, which have all these oxygen and hydrogen little add-ons on the side. Right? He dropped into the lateral mode. And we've all had that experience. Something comes to us, pop. And just Stories of Awakening, a wonderful book by James Austin. Selfless Insight, is in which he's trying to plausibly kind of do sort of, I mean, he's trying to do the same kind of thing I'm trying to do, neurodharma, you know, applied neurodharma. He's trying to think through within a Zen frame what in the world happens in Kensho, right? And he talks about a number of examples where there's surprise, they're startled. Right? A lot of Zen stories where the Zen master does something just startling, or there's suddenly the sound, right, of the crow. You know, that's when the moment happens. Okay. What? Oh, James Austin. It's called Selfless Insight. It's pretty technical, and yet it's also very, I think, accessible. Some of his previous books, they're legendary. No one reads them. They all claim them. I have one. I haven't read it. You know, it's, my computer monitor sits on it, and I kind of hope some mojo will rise up and infuse my work, some deep wisdom of Zen and neurology from James. But anyway.
It's in the bookstore.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so there's a place for medial mode. On the other hand, I think there's way too much medial activation. I think it does have a kind of hegemony. And, you know, if there's a capital city inside the mind-brain, it tends to be located in the midline, and the provinces are out on the sides. And I think there's an imbalance of power. We need to shift power increasingly to the provinces. Capitals are useful, but it's just kind of out of whack, I think, in the typical modern Western, you know, mind and brain, with many important exceptions, people who've managed to preserve and create refuge for, you know, medial, lateral, rather, activations. So let's talk about some ways to activate the lateral mode and then move to a wrap. I think we're good on time. But before I do anything experiential here, which might be a nice way to segue into the dinner period, and then we'll come back later this evening and be able to talk more about this. Any comments or questions so far? Right there, yeah?
How many of the brains that are being scanned for these things are females? And how many are males? And are they noticing the difference? Like that somewhere ages ago, the corpus callosum or something being larger, and
right.
Two sides of the brain working to do math problems in females.
Right.
Yeah. Really quite different.
So they're. There are a couple kind of layers in your question or and comment. One is with regard to this particular distinction, you know, medial mode, lateral mode. This is an area of emerging development. And within the FARB study, I'll actually go back and look at it. You can as well. I don't know what the subjects were. To be really honest, it's very interesting. Very often they exclude women from research who are menstruating because they don't want to take that into account as another variable. So, for example, a little detail, you may not know this. You know oxytocin, the bonding, love and bonding hormone? Until very recently, there was not one study on human subjects of oxytocin, which is about 7 times more prevalent in females than in males, human females and human males. There was not one single study on oxytocin with female subjects. Almost all the research you'll read about oxytocin is about men because they didn't want to take into account the rise and the fall related to reproductive hormones rising and falling of a woman's cycle. So all that said, I don't know the detail of whether these subjects are also female. My kind of hunch